Hello, everyone. It's good to be speaking to you. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Josh. I'm one of the clergy here at St. Nick's. And it's so good to be speaking to you, carrying on in the second week of our Lent sermon series, Practices, together. In this series, we've been taking time to unpack what the practices of the church are. These kind of discipleship practices passed to us from Jesus and down through the church on how we live a life in response to what Jesus has done for us. Matt kicked us off last week looking at obedience. What does it mean to be led by Jesus, to let Jesus lead you? And over the next few weeks, we'll be unpacking the practices of sacrifice, reconciliation, hospitality, and proclamation. And today, we're going to be looking together at the spiritual practice of generosity. How Jesus calls us to practice generosity, have a heart for generosity in all aspects of our lives, and what generosity is. What does it look like? To do this, we'll be unpacking a passage from Luke describing Jesus' interaction with a woman in the house of Simon the Pharisee from Luke 7, 36 to 50. So grab your Bible or whatever you use and let's read that together now. When one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. A woman in that town who lived a sinful life learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house. So she came there with an alabaster jar of perfume. As she stood behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured the perfume on them. When the Pharisee who'd invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." Jesus answered him, "Simon, I have something to tell you." "Tell me, teacher," he said. Two people owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii, the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he forgave the debts of both. Now which of them will love him more? Simon replied, "I suppose the one who had the bigger debt forgiven." "You have judged correctly," Jesus said. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I came into your house and you did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven little loves little." Then Jesus said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." The other guests began to say amongst themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" Jesus said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." So what does God say about generosity? Giving, serving, they're all things we know we're supposed to be involved with as Christians, right? But why? What is that about? Where does it come from? Why should we do it? The biblical narrative on generosity can arguably be seen to begin with what was known in the Old Testament as the tithe. The people of God who've been chosen by God, rescued by him, are given the law that was to teach them how to live in right relationship with the God who made them, loved them, chose them, and saved them. And within it, in Leviticus 27:30, we get this: "A tithe of everything from the land, whether grain from the soil or fruit from the trees, belongs to the Lord. It is holy to the Lord." Essentially, what we hear is the first 10% of everything belongs to the Lord, and we should freely give it back to him. And it's easy to hear that as a rule or a regulation, right? It sounds quite precise, quite legalistic. It sounds like it could work quite well in a farming context, but I don't know about you, but I'm not producing much in my garden that would be of use to anyone. It can sound like some sort of church tax, right? So what is this about? Galatians 3 says this: the purpose of the law was to keep a broken people in the way of salvation until Jesus came, inheriting the promise and distributing them to us. If such is the case, is the law then an anti-promise, a negation of God's will for us? Not at all. Its purpose was to make obvious to everyone that we are in ourselves out of right relationship with God, and therefore to show us the futility of devising some religious system, forgetting by our own efforts what we could only get by waiting in faith for God to complete his promise. So we see that the law that was given was to show us that God is a generous, abundant God, and that we are naturally an ungenerous people called to generosity. But also that no amount of generosity can earn us right relationship with God. It is, as Galatians put it, futile to think that. So what does this arc show us? It shows us that we aren't bound to generous living to win God's love, to make us right with God, or to change anything in this world for the better. God makes the first move every single time. What we see is that generosity doesn't come before grace. Generosity is a response to grace. I love what it said in our passage: her many sins have been forgiven as her great love has shown. Her great love flowed as a response to the forgiveness of sins and the grace that she found in Jesus. Generosity doesn't buy you proximity with Jesus. Generosity is a response to proximity with Jesus. Let's look at the woman in our passage. This is one of my all-time favorite interactions in the Bible. It's my all-time favorite guide of what it looks like to practice the way of Jesus. It calls me back time and time again when I get lost, because we see so beautifully that devotion is a response to grace. Devotion from the woman in response to the grace that she finds in Jesus. This woman is known, it says, as a sinner in the city. In this context, the public knowledge about the sinfulness of the woman undoubtedly tells us that she's a prostitute. And to the holiness-focused Jews of the time, she would have been seen as the lowest of the low, not only because of her immoral trade, but because she would no doubt fraternize with Gentiles, non-Jews, for the purposes of business. So it seems so shocking that a woman such as this would enter the home of a prominent Pharisee like Simon, you know, someone known in the community as a moral religious leader. She would enter his home and approach Jesus, a teacher. But she does. And don't you just love how Luke puts it so casually, like it's not even a big deal, as if that was totally normal and not shocking? Because she's a broken person, and she's come in search of Jesus, the friend of broken people. It gets even more scandalous, though. In Greco-Roman culture, the hair was seen as an extremely erotic thing. Considering the fact that this woman would already be being viewed as a temptress by those present at the dinner, the fact that she lets down her hair as she approaches Jesus would be seen as a really shocking thing. It would be seen as an erotic act, especially when she subsequently begins to touch Jesus and kiss his feet. No self-respecting woman would dare behave in this way in front of the men gathered at this meal. But that's the point, isn't it? Extravagant generosity leaves no room for self-respect. Sacrificial love doesn't have a limit based on what becomes embarrassing. It is brutally raw without a care for itself. And you know, prostitution was rife in the time of Jesus. With personal hygiene being at a pretty low point in history anyway, you can imagine that prostitution was even less hygienic again. I'm sorry to be crude, but it's so relevant. Because the perfume that she outpours on the feet of Jesus
would have been to cover the smell of her trade. Therefore, in this beautiful act of extravagant giving, she's not only giving away her probably one of her most wealthy worldly possessions, but she's outpouring her life and soul before Jesus. She's completely turning her back on her old way of life and completely giving herself over to what Jesus wants for her and is calling her into. She doesn't stash a bit in case this plan with Jesus doesn't pan out and she needs to turn back to her old trade. She's encountered Jesus and everything has changed. She is a new creation and she gives it all to run after him. This is not a 10% mentality, generosity that is just enough to be doing the right thing or the done thing. She's come face to face with Jesus, face to face with her Savior, face to face with the grace and love of Jesus. And so, of course, there is no limit to the outpouring that follows in response. Grace means everything to her. And so she outpours everything in response. What devotion. I don't know about you, but I wait till Christmas each year for my bottle of scent or whatever I'm going to wear until essentially that someone with more money than me can buy it for me, right? And then I monitor it quite closely throughout the year to ensure that it's going to get me through to next December when we can repeat the cycle. I mean, it's been kind of messed up a little bit by having a child. If you've not got one, don't do it. You're like your extended family. Stop buying you gifts and start buying gifts for them instead. And it's crazy. But it's expensive stuff, right? All this smelly stuff. But honestly, in comparison to the time of our interaction in today's reading, it's nothing. It's predicted that the bottle of perfume that she outpours on the feet of Jesus would have cost more than a year's salary for this woman. It would have been one of her only possessions, and she would have used it extremely sparingly. And then she pours the whole lot out on the feet of Jesus. It doesn't get much more extravagant than that. But even further than this, Luke takes the opportunity here to outline the differences in reaction between the host, Simon, the Pharisee, the good, religious, upright guy who was known in the community as a good guy and was bound by a strict code of hospitality, and the woman who wasn't invited, was known as a sinner, wasn't supposed to be there, didn't have a seat at the table. We read in verse 44 to 45, I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Simon has dishonored Jesus as his guest by not fulfilling his role as a host. And the woman has fulfilled it. However, we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that she's merely done what Simon should have done. Jesus shows this. Custom dictated that he had some water for his feet, but she washes them herself with her tears. Custom dictated he was given a towel to dry them, but she dries them herself with her hair. Custom dictated a single kiss on the cheek or the hand, but she lavishes kisses upon his feet. Custom dictated that his head be anointed with household olive oil, but she anoints his feet and not just with olive oil, but with costly perfume. All of her actions are done at the feet of Jesus, the most unclean part of the body, which just shows all the more extraordinary the humility of the act. You see, she doesn't just follow the custom that would be sufficient to honor Jesus. She goes as far as she possibly can in an act of extreme, extravagant generosity, devotion, and outpouring of sacrificial love. That is what we are called to this evening. That is what biblical generosity looks like in response to what Jesus has done for us. She's encountered the grace of Jesus and her whole mentality about what matters has shifted. So that is my first point today, that you are saved by grace and grace alone. You are free. And that Christian generosity, discipled generosity, is only ever as a response to God's move in our life. A response to God making the first move. Not responding so God moves, but a response in outpouring at God's move in our lives. Not a regulation, but a state of the heart. Sacrificial love outpoured in freedom in response to who Jesus is. The second point that I wanted to make this evening is that this practice of generosity, this state of the heart response to who Jesus is and what he's done, touches every part of our lives. I remember a time while I was at Vicar Factory, Hannah and I had a neighbor who was a political asylum seeker from Iran called Arash. He'd fled for his life. He was being housed by the Bristol Hospitality Network, legends. And he lived next door to us. And it was like really culturally important for him to like cook outside. And he was an amazing cook. And one day he asked to borrow my barbecue. Anyone who knows me and has heard me talk about my barbecue before will be like slowly inhaling now. Because for me, that's like, you know, asking to name my firstborn child after you or something. I don't know. But essentially, it was a huge deal. And I thought, you know what? This guy has nothing. He can borrow my barbecue. Of course he can. Then he bunt a load of wood in it. It's not really made for that. So I was like, mate, next time you borrow it, could you use the charcoal? Look, I've got some charcoal. You help yourself to it freely. He borrowed it again. He bunt a load more wood in it. This time the handle melted and a little bit of my soul died. And then we had a less British conversation this time. And I was like, don't burn wood in it. Use the charcoal, you know. And he borrowed it again and it happened again. And this time a bit of the enamel flaked off. And now I was dying inside. And I thought, you know what? I need to be really generous here. So I got Arash his own barbecue. And I got him his own barbecue tools and his own stock of charcoal. And I was like, here you go. This, I give it to you freely. This is yours. You don't need to borrow my barbecue anymore. And then his got left somewhere and he used mine again. And in the end, I had to have a strong word with myself as I felt the graciousness of Jesus say, look, Josh, you can't buy your way out of being generous with your things. Because there was no part of me that was being generous in this scenario. It was all a ploy so that I would get to keep my barbecue nice and how I wanted it to be. There was no generosity of heart involved in this, and I felt that gentle rebuke. Because that's what we believe, right? Generosity is in all aspects of our life. You can't do one to negate doing another. It's a posture of the heart that we see in all things. And we see this from the woman in our passage. She's generous with her possessions, yes. But she's also generous with her devotion. Generous with her pride as she humbles herself. Generous with the way that she might be perceived by the onlookers. Generous with her reputation. There's this phenomenal passage in Acts where we get this snapshot into the early life of the church. I'll read it now. It's in Acts 2, the rubber is hitting the road for the early church, and this is what we hear. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. So easy to hear that, right, and think, oh man, that sounds so idyllic. We're so far from that. They had it so right. How have we got it so wrong? I mean, I'd like to say that the church in Acts, in case you feel like that, was just as messed up as our church is, because it was filled with messy, broken people just like us. But I love what we see in that snapshot about the things they were generous in. They were generous with their humility, devoting themselves to teaching. And we kind of lose the significance of that in our context. This is basically, they were being taught by the apostles who, you know, a couple years before fishermen. So they're essentially saying in a culture with like crazy honor for teachers, and teachers were so well trained and so honored in society, I need to learn from this fisherman, you know? That's crazy. They were generous with their humility, devoting themselves to that teaching. They were generous with their time, devoting themselves to fellowship together. Intentional time. They were generous with their prayer as they grappled for the kingdom to come around them. They were generous with their faith, standing in that risky space and asking for miracles. They were generous with their possessions, radically selling everything they needed to so that the poor might have their needs met. They were generous with their hospitality, breaking bread together in their homes with those that they shouldn't have crossed paths with in society. The generosity they display in this outpouring of love for Jesus as a response to the grace that they found in him is all-encompassing. And you know, a bit later in Acts 6, so that's four chapters later. I don't know how much time that is. Could have been a big afternoon, could have been months, hard to know. But in Acts 6, a bit later on, we have this moment where the apostles are like, oh, it wouldn't be right for us to wait on the tables of the widows and orphans because that's causing us to neglect our time like praying and teaching. And you know what we see? The apostles who say that, the apostles who choose to shut off their generosity in one aspect of their lives and use another area of generosity as an excuse for that, fade to the background of the story. They fade to the background of the story. And what we see is the apostles who they appoint to feed the widows and orphans take up the mantle of the Holy Spirit as the gospel spreads out in all directions. They're the ones who carry the flame now as their generosity outpours in all areas of their life. It's a big challenge, I know, but I think what we see is something in there about that heart outpouring that can't be contained to the things we're willing to be generous with and the things that we're not. An outpouring of the heart in devotion encapsulates all areas of our life. This is something that God has really been challenging me about and speaking to me about at the moment. Those of you who know my wife Hannah and I will know, and we heard a bit in the prayers maybe earlier, that we have a real heart for South Bristol that God has put on our hearts. And I think God's been doing something really significant in challenging me at the moment, because it would be easy for Hannah and I to say we're so sacrificial and we're so generous in pursuit of our heart for South Bristol, our heart to see God move in South Bristol. You know, we've given a lot of time, we've given a lot of money, we've made a lot of sacrifices. We live there in quite a tricky neighborhood. We love that neighborhood, but sometimes it's a sacrificial love to be there. And it costs us. So it would be easy for us to say, you know, we've been so generous. And I've recently felt really challenged by the Lord. And he said, Josh, you've not been generous on your knees for South Bristol. You've not been generous with your pride. You've not been generous with your willingness to admit that you don't have the answer and that you can't do it without me. And God has been really challenging me to be generous with my pride, with my time spent in prayer, with my crying out for God to move in South Bristol. And it's been an amazing few weeks, to be honest. I'm sorry, I'm getting quite emotional because I don't seem to be able to talk about it at the moment without crying. But it's been an amazing few weeks where I've started to let my heart outpour to God in the prayer, in the contending, in the stuff that I can't control or I don't have a plan for or is too big for me to deal with. And I think it's pretty obvious in South Bristol that something is happening at the moment that is too big for any of us to deal with, and we need the Lord. So I've been in that prayer room on my knees, covered in snot and tears, crying out for South Bristol. But you know what? You can't outgive God. He's met me in those moments like I haven't experienced for such a long time. He has grown my heart in a way that I haven't experienced for that place in such a long time. And it's been the greatest privilege to outpour to God and feel him and know him meet me in that moment and hear him proclaim hope over a place that feels so hopeless. So can I invite you to join me this evening and ask God where he's inviting you to grow in your generosity? What area of your life he's asking you to take a step of growth in? What area could you be more intentionally generous in? Maybe it's an area of generosity that you need to rediscover. We talk a lot in this community about praying, serving, and giving, right? That isn't because these are things that we need or things that you should maybe pick your favorite one that you're passionate about. They aren't things that we want from you. They're things that we want for you. Because they tend to be indicators of a heart outpouring to Jesus, and Jesus meets us in that moment in a way we can't comprehend. Because this posture of an outpouring heart encapsulates every area of our lives. And finally, this evening, we see that practicing generosity is to prophetically declare the abundance of God. In our passage, we don't see Jesus chastise the woman for her generosity, or tell her to be sparing with her outpouring, or cautious with her possessions or her reputation. And I believe that that's because in Jesus, we see him constantly act out a kingdom mentality on generosity. And it is simply this: God is a good God, a God of abundance, who made everything and to whom everything belongs. And he does not hold out on his children. God is a good God, a God of abundance, who made everything and to whom everything belongs, and he does not hold out on his children. Jesus lived as though he truly believed the promise that he makes in Matthew 7:11. If you, then though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? Jesus' mindset of the abundance of God meant he could live sacrificially and generously from the stable to the resurrection, even towards his enemies. That's why when he said seemingly wild things like, sell your possessions and give them to the poor, or don't worry about your life, he's inviting us to live by a different story. One where we stand up to and call out the lie that there is not enough for what it is, a lie. The birth, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus show that God can turn death to life, evil to good, despair to hope, and scarcity to abundance. When we believe that there is enough, we begin to see opportunities for generosity all around us, or opportunities to experience the abundance of God's new kingdom. I spoke this message this morning at church, and before the service, I was stood in that little dark bit at the back over there, quickly reading my notes again to refamiliarize myself with them. And my one-year-old son came up to me, and he got his face right in my face. And I said, oh, what have you got? And he said, pastry. And I said, can I have some? And he said, yeah. And he just shoved it straight in my mouth. And this is not because my toddler is wildly generous. I don't know if you've met a lot of toddlers, but generosity is not really a trait you tend to see in toddlers. So what was going on there? Well, what was going on is that Amos believes when he's in this building that there is no shortage of pastry. At any given moment during the service, he can walk up to the cafe at the back, look longingly into the eyes of the person on cafe and say, pastry, please, and he'll get another one. He doesn't think that they're ever run out. There is an abundance of pastry when Amos is in this building. So, of course, he will freely share the one he's got in his hand now. He can just go and get another one. When we believe that there is enough, we begin to see opportunities for generosity all around us. Opportunities to experience the abundance of God's new kingdom. To practice generosity is to prophetically declare to a broken and frustrated world that has a mentality of scarcity that leads to violence and disorder that there is a God of abundance who is for them and has good things for them that will never run out. There is always enough in Jesus. So there we have it. a potted history of the practice of generosity as the people of God, a prophetic declaration of the abundance of God, a state of the heart that encapsulates all things and all areas of our life, and a practice that all flows from the grace of Jesus as an outpouring of love to the God who runs to meet us with forgiveness and freedom before we even know we need it. Let's grow together in the practice of generosity and be marked as a people who practice generosity in all they do. And my challenge this evening is to ask of Jesus, where are you calling me to grow in my heart of generosity? And that's what we're going to do now. We're going to ask the Lord together, because this is about you and him. This is about your heart in response to who he is. So should we stand together? We're going to pray, and we're going to ask the Lord to speak to us about our heart of generosity.